Hello, this is Radio Free Canada. I'm your host, Kevin Annett. Welcome back. It's Sunday, March 19th. We're here every Sunday at 3 p.m. Pacific at the BBS Radio Network. Follow our work at itccs.org, murderbydecree.com. Well, today we've got the final in our five-part lecture series on the roots of genocide. We'll be playing that on the last half of the show. This is a pre-recorded show. I am on a retreat this week, and so you'll be hearing the last of my pre-recorded shows. I wanted to cover a couple of things before we go to the final lecture, though. First of all, the big announcement, of course, is that our fifth book is out this week on Amazon.com and CreateSpace.com. It's the Establishing the Reign of Common Liberty, a common law training manual. It's out, and there have been a number of revisions to it. It's basically a manual for those who want to get astute in the common law and how to set up common law courts and enforce these verdicts in their community. You can see more about that at itccs.org. To give you an example of how successful this book has been, normally when we produce these books, we're selling them about an average of one a day. In the first couple of days, we had 30 sold because of this enormous and growing interest in the common law. So that's very encouraging. And further in that regard, we are having a, and we just organized this week, a common law training workshop being held in Kitchener, Ontario. It's been organized by the Southern Ontario Council for Common Law, which is affiliated with the ITCCAS. That's all day Saturday, April 15th in Kitchener, Ontario. If you'd like to be part of that common law training workshop, please write to republicofcanada@gmail.com. In the workshop, we'll be having a number of activists come together to share lessons, talk about the techniques of training in the common law, how to set up courts, how to make citizen arrests, and all of this other very good stuff to learn, and how to apply these lessons to the various campaigns we're involved in, especially in great interest to the Southern Ontario folks, the fight against the so-called Children's Aid Society, the trafficked children, and police corruption and criminality in the courts. That's going to be one of the major foci of that training workshop. So that's Saturday, April 15th. Now, the significance of that date as well, it's the 12th anniversary of the launching of Aboriginal Holocaust Memorial Day. And that is really the movement that forced the apology for genocide out of the Canadian government, so-called apology, as if you can apologize for 65,000 dead children. But the whole movement to force that change and bring the truth of genocide out began on our first Aboriginal Holocaust Day, April 15th, 2005. And we're commemorating that on Saturday, the 15th, not just with that workshop in Kitchener, but all over the country. There'll be actions. That's the Easter weekend. And so there will be actions outside and inside various Catholic, Anglican, and United churches. The church is still responsible under moral law and the law of the land for these crimes against humanity. So please stay tuned to itccs.org about more actions in your neighborhood against these criminal bodies on Aboriginal Holocaust Day, 12th anniversary, April 15th. Keep an eye open for that. And finally, in terms of the lecture today, I wanted to point out a number of things. Now, this lecture series, as you might have noticed by now, was recorded 15 years ago in 2002, and a lot more evidence has come in since then, and I've changed my perspective in some ways. I think it's become even more radical in the fundamentally corrupt and criminal nature of the regime we've lived under for centuries. But there's a few corrections I wanted to make. You'll notice in the lecture series, it doesn't have as much evidence on the death rate. How the death rate in residential schools started the very first year they began. That really wasn't mentioned in the lecture series. Again, go to murderbydecree.com for all of this evidence. But we know that in the very first year these Indian schools opened in Canada, half the children were dying off. Various missionaries, shanks, and inoculating children who then died en masse from smallpox. Again, that wasn't covered in the lecture series. And other stuff that, you know, is related to the fact that there was intentionality in all this. So without further ado, we will play this last of our lecture series from 2002 now. And of course, I'm on leave only this week. I'll be back again next week live on the air, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern Time. So until then, please follow our work, itccs.org, murderbydecree.com, and prepare for the mid-April events to hold these churches not just accountable, but to actually stop the operation of these criminal church and secular bodies that are continuing to ravage the innocent and commit genocide on all our peoples. So until next week, I hope you enjoy the lecture series, and stay strong and stay clear. We'll be back next week. Thank you.
And to carry on from last week, if you remember, I introduced the whole thing of residential schools and where they came from. An idea developed in the 1800s pretty much in Quebec, where the Catholic school began to experiment in, and this is interesting, the Catholic Church, at the behest of the British colonial administration, set up schools whereby French-Canadian children would be taught only English. So it was kind of like a precursor to the residential schools. Now, the difference, of course, is we're not an oral culture. In the oral cultures of the Native nations across Canada, language very much was a demarcation between one territory and another, especially in BC, where over half the native languages are found in Canada. There was a lot of linguistic diversity. And one of the things that people continually tell us is how, the trap lines and hunting territories and fishing areas were established by where one dialect ended and another began. So if you're a colonial power and you come in and you want to take somebody's land, in that situation what you want to do is confuse the languages and the dialects so that nobody knows, A, what their land is anymore, and B, who they're related to, because it's all based on kinship. Now, if you confuse that, you've effectively destroyed the claim those people have to their own land. And that's why the residential schools and the land seizure were very closely linked, because that was the main purpose of the residential schools. Time and again, the destruction of language uniformly in every single residential school, that's what you find. The children are brought in and they're beaten and even worse things done to them if they speak their own language, just terrorized to forget their language. There's even the case of a group of Cowichan men and women who were part of the group that was taken over to Edmonton. What tended to happen was in northern BC, the kids were shipped into Alberta and for some reason. And a lot of them ended up at this place called the Charles Campbell Hospital in Edmonton, which is run by the United Church. And several of my friends there describe how, and it's very moving, actually. I went to a healing circle in Nanaimo, and Doug, one of these native men, said, I hadn't remembered anything about what went on there until I read your book, and then you made reference in there to electric shocks. And suddenly it all came back. I remember that when I was carrying the bodies, after I carried the bodies of these children out of the hospital and we put them in this burial site, they gave me these electric shocks so I'd forget. And he said, I couldn't say the name of my mother in my own language, and that's something you never forget, yet I have forgotten how to say it. And so definitely I think there was all sorts of experimentation going on, too, and how to, you know, get rid of language in other ways as well. But I think, again, it's an example of how behind the horrific practices there's an intent, and the intent is to destroy the identity of people so that they don't claim the land as their own anymore. And I think by now we realize how much was at stake from the point of view of just the amount of wealth here on the coast. For those of you who don't know, one of the reasons I got thrown out of the United Church is I discovered that the church had been selling native land to various logging companies, which are financial backers of the church. And this one, to give you a case study, and I mentioned this fellow last time, John Ross, he was a missionary, Presbyterian missionary, sent out among the Hausa people of Vancouver Island, and he was given magistrate powers by the provincial government in 1903. So he was church and state rolled into one. He was the local court, he was the missionary, and he's in these special courts, he used that power to arrest any native chief who wouldn't surrender their land or send their children to a residential school. And he got land from them that way. And what happened was this land that he basically stole from the Hausas ended up in the hands of the United Church when the Presbyterians joined them in 1925. Now, I found out about this in 1994 because I'd been doing a lot of funerals up in Hausa. That's, if you know the area north of Tofino in the Clarkquot Sound, it's a place called Flores Island. And it was the ancestral homeland of the Hausas. And one of the times that I was there, we had done the funeral. It was really a moving funeral. One of the elders had died. And when I got there, the entire village had emptied. Men, women, children, the smallest little baby, right up, everybody was there. And they were accompanying the coffin of this elder. And I really had an amazing sense of that they were a community. They were like a family. That they had still, despite all these terrible things that had happened to them, they had stayed strong and together. And it was really beautiful to see that. But at that funeral, after the whenever there's a funeral or wedding, there's like 2 days of feasting. And during that time, it was one of the reasons I put on so much weight then. But during the time after the funeral, a fellow called Chief Earl George began to tell me about this history of what happened to the land there and how John Ross is that missionary. His grandson had been sold all this big chunk of land, 200 hectares of old-growth red cedar, for $2,000. The United Church had sold it really cheap to the guy's grandson, who then flipped it and sold it to McMillan Bloedel for $50,000 or more, I think $58,000. And then McMillan Bloedel is selling it for, it was actually part of, if you remember, Weyerhaeuser took over Mack Blow, biggest corporate takeover in BC history. One of the reasons that happened is they wanted to get into the last of that old growth. There's only, if you look at a map, there's hardly anything left on Vancouver Island. One of the ways they got that old growth was because of these deals going on between the church and the company. So anyway, the very fact that when I wrote a letter about that to the church, I was then tossed out of my pulpit 4 weeks later and eventually thrown out of the church, it tells you something about how important, you know, that whole history is to the power structure here in the province. I mean, in a colonial system, and a thing to remember in Canada, we never had a... There was an attempted revolution in 1837 to bring in responsible government, and that was defeated. William Lyon Mackenzie in Upper Canada and Louis Papineau in Lower Canada. And the thing that defeated them was this, what they call the Family Compact, which was a small little group. There's a great play about this by Rick Salutin called 1837, The Farmers' Revolt. I don't know if you've seen it. But it's a beautiful play about this whole history. And the people who ran Canada then are pretty much the same people who run it now. And there's a small little elite. And they're all integrated. At the time, it was the church, you know, the Anglican Church in Upper Canada, the Catholic Church in Lower Canada, a colonial administration, the judges, and the, you know, small wealthy class. Well, when you look at what goes on in Canada today, it's the same arrangement. It's not the British Empire now, it's the Americans, by and large, who are holding the strings, but it's the same kind of colonial arrangement. And the example I give about that is not only the existence of positions like governor general or lieutenant governor, those are colonial appointments, you know, people who are accountable to the Queen in London, but not to the people here. Something most people don't know, in BC, it's not the police who lay criminal charges, it's the attorney general. So that's an old colonial system whereby the party in power gets to tell the police who to lay charges against and who not to lay charges against, you know. If one of their friends gets arrested, the attorney general can intervene and tell the police not to do anything. And that's still the same way. The police do not have autonomy to lay their own criminal charges separate from the Crown Council, who's an appointee of the Attorney General. So all of this is really relevant because when it comes, as you were saying earlier, why is it that Native chiefs who are state-funded, church leaders, other people don't want this stuff to come out? Because as with this case of the House of Land deal, exposing any part of this exposes the whole arrangement. And suddenly Canadians can see that, well, we don't live in a democratic system, you know. It's how could these crimes have been committed and yet the churches and governments still are not being held accountable for them? Well, it's because, you know, when you have a state-appointed judiciary, a media that's monopolized and operates according to a system whereby, I don't know if you know this either, but when I was in Toronto talking to some people at the CBC where the filming was going on, they said that in order for a television station to get licensed, the lawyer has to provide to the, you know, the people that CRTC, a thing called, I think I've forgotten the exact term, but it's to prove that you've never been sued. Not that you've never been sued successfully, but that nobody has ever brought a lawsuit against you. Well, in order to get certified, you can't have ever done anything to bring a lawsuit against you. Now, that's absurd. If you're in any way media that is probing into these things, you're going to offend somebody somewhere, and they're going to threaten you with a lawsuit. Well, instead of, like in the States, the burden of proof is on the person who is claiming that they've been libeled to prove that they have been libeled. In Canada, it's the other way around. The burden of proof, let's say I suspect that one of you is doing something of a criminal nature, and I say to the police, I suspect so-and-so is, you know, guilty of whatever. In Canada, that person can then sue me for having made the allegation, and it's up to me to prove that it isn't true, or that it is true. And that's kind of asked backwards. I mean, the way under common law, if you libel has no defense, if there's a, let me put this another way, if there's a basis to you believing that this is true, then that's your defense in a libel case. So, for example, when this stuff first began to come out, and we had a forum in 1998 where Native survivors of the school were describing what had gone on. As soon as the testimonies went public, the United Church began to issue statements about, this is libelous against these missionaries and other people. On four or five, I've lost track, different occasions, I've been served papers by the church, cease and desist notices. You're not to talk about this anymore. I just ignore them because it's my right to talk about these things. And they never follow through with them, but it's a scare tactic. Well, you see, lawsuits, the threat of a lawsuit is used not only to shut people down, but to shut the media down. And that was my original point, that the media in Canada, all you have to do to shut up the media is to say, I'm going to sue you if you talk about me. And then they'll be quiet. So that is not a free press. That is a controlled press that's controlled by the people with the money and the power to threaten them with lawsuits. So in that context, it's really, obviously, we're at a great disadvantage in terms of bringing out this information. But at the same time, all of that is a great advantage, because the minute you provoke the beast, if you like, it has less legitimacy. It exposes itself very easily. Now I'm trying to think of an example of that. I can't at the moment, but something will come to mind. The point is that if you take a step back and look at what we're dealing with here, we're talking about a policy devised in 1910 in Ottawa between the various, by the Anglican, the Catholic, the Presbyterian, Methodist churches, and different wings of the government, to legally enshrine these things called residential schools. And I began initially to talk about that. And what this did is it created a legal framework for these residential schools. Basically, it said the churches run them, the government sets up the structure and provides, you know, the legitimacy and some funding for them. But it's pretty much a church operation. And on two occasions that I found in the 1930s and the 50s, the government, the federal government, tried to close residential schools. But each time, the churches in the 30s, the churches threatened to start a big public campaign to bring down the government if they closed the residential schools. And in the 50s, it was done more subtly, but the pressure was nevertheless there as well, that the churches made the argument that if we're going to make these children good Christians, they have to be in these boarding schools away from their parents. In some ways, I think the churches were being the front men for other interests, like, as we see on the island, these logging companies that needed to get in there, and they couldn't log off these areas if they were still habitated by large Native communities. As I mentioned the first time, the pre-contact population of Vancouver Island was probably 250,000 Native people. And by 1920, it had fallen to about 20,000, 10 to 20,000. So, I mean, the area, it was open for exploitation by logging companies and others. Again, not accidentally. Where I left off last time was I took us up to the period around the 1930s, and I showed you a document which really has created a big tempest in a teacup. And it's kind of funny the way I found this. It's called the Application for Admission Form. Now, in 1996, when these lawsuits first began, if you remember, or maybe you don't, but in February 96, the first lawsuits began from residential school survivors. It was 15 Native men and women from Port Alberni, and they were suing the United Church and the federal government for assaults and other things done to them when they were children. The immediate reaction of the church was to say, the government ran the schools. It was their thing. They were saying, go to Ottawa, blame them. Ottawa was saying, no, the churches were running them. So they were doing this kind of mutual finger-pointing thing going on. And it was really funny because right in the middle of that, right when that debate was going on, I was in UBC Library one day. I was working on a PhD. That's after I'd been tossed out of the church. And it's funny because that same year, the Kerner Library at UBC had acquired all of these microfilms from the Indian Affairs Department where they showed the residential school records. And one of the things I found there one day, it was really amazing. I don't think it was accidental. I see this document staring out at me, and it's the application for admission form, which every Native parent had to sign, and it signed away legal guardianship to the principal. Now, this happened sometime between 1929 and 1933 for the first time. Now, up to then, if you remember from last time, the Indians were made legal wards of the state by the Indian Act in 1874. That means when you're a ward of the state, it means you're like a child or somebody who's mentally deficient. You can't act or speak for yourself. So all Native people are wards of the state. They're considered children or mental patients under the law. So they need the state to act for them. They can't go to court. They can't open a bank account. They can't vote. They're totally dependent, which is what you have to do if you're going to remove the people from the land and exterminate them legally. Now, suddenly, in 1929, the government makes the churches their legal wards. Now, this makes no sense because the churches are in no position to act as the legal guardians of these children, in the residential schools perhaps, but the churches aren't in a position of acting as legal wards. They're not, you know, established on the reserves. They're not in the same relationship as the government has with them. And yet, nevertheless...
Sorry, it was an application for admission to a school?
Yes, I'm trying to find it. It's in here. And it's a form whereby it says the parent had to sign it, and it said, grant permission for my child to attend the school, and I make the principal the legal guardian under supervision of the Ministry of Mines and Resources in Ottawa, which is Indians were under Mines and Resources significantly, to remain therein under the guardianship of the principal for such term as the Minister of Mines and Resources may deem proper. The parent had to sign it. If they didn't sign it, they'd go to jail under the law. They could go to jail or be fined $500, which was a tremendous amount back then. And so this form, I found this in the UBC library, and I held a press conference, and it was, I said, well, it's funny the churches are claiming they're not legally liable for the residential schools, because here they were the legal guardians. And it was so funny what happened. We held a press conference at the old United Church Conference Office on 4th Avenue, and the CBC and all these media were there, and they were eating this up. They, you know, this was great. It was significant. There was no story ever run about it, though. Like with a lot of these stories, it was blacked out. The reporters were enthusiastic about it, but the editors didn't let it into the press. But when we were there doing the press conference, I was being interviewed by the CBC. These two officials in the United Church came out, and they went through my briefcase, and they took out. I had this information. And when you look at, they didn't know that the whole thing was being filmed by Cable 4, so we have a film clip of this. And it's so funny what happened, because these two guys, they were the two fellows actually who had me tossed out of the church, the lawyer John Jessaman, who's the United Church lawyer in BC, and then Brian Thorpe, who is one of the chief executive officers of the church. These two top officials, they come out, Jessaman the lawyer, very symbolically, he's kind of standing in the doorway telling the church guy what to do. Thorpe goes over and very hesitantly takes this document out of my briefcase and then hurries off into the building. And when somebody told me about it, that it happened, I couldn't believe it. You know, these guys would rip off my stuff in public. But I go into the church building, and there's Thorpe at the photocopying machine, photocopying all this stuff. And I say, Brian, I'd like that. I would like my stuff back. You took that out of my bag without my permission. I'd like it back. And it was so pathetic. I mean, he took it and he was trying to hide it. And he said, oh, no, I never did it. And then, like a little kid who's been caught, you know. And finally, the lawyer comes forward and says, never mind, Brian, it doesn't matter. Just give them back to him. And so he returns these unstapled sheets to me. And I go, and this is going back to what I said earlier about the Crown Council laying charges and how politicized the whole process is in BC. I got the tape of the theft, and I got affidavits from people who saw it, and I went to the Crown Council downtown, and I said, I want to lay a charge against these people for stealing my stuff. And he, when he heard about it, he said, oh, well, I'll have to get back to you. It was 5 months. And I pressured these people. I said, when are you going to investigate this? When are you going to make a decision? Finally, this guy, Garth Gibson, who's the Crown Counsel, said, I've decided it's not in the public interest to pursue this. Right? And I said, how is it not in the public interest? These are documents that are related to this very important issue happening now, showing that churches are legally liable. Church officials steal the documents, and I think it's an attempt by them to cover up this whole thing. So I wanted to lay charges. He refused. Now, in another province, the police could have proceeded independently, but in BC, they were shut down. The Attorney General at the time, it was Ujjal Dosanjh, and he's close friends with John Kishore, who was Aboriginal Affairs Minister when this land deal happened, and a United Church clergyman. And it was Kishore who kind of brokered the deal whereby the church was got off the hook when the scandal broke that it had been selling off land to the to McMillan Bodell. So he was using his office to protect his church, and then his friend, the Attorney General, made sure that none of the charges were laid against these church officials who had ripped off my stuff. So, I mean, it shows you it's like a close little group operating. But the significant thing about this document... Pardon me? I was so encumbered with other stuff at the time, I didn't. And in fact, at the time, I didn't know that you could lay private information. And going, looking back, I should have. A private information, you can write out a statement and take it before a judge, and they have to hear it. They have to make some kind of ruling about it. So I should have. But what this document did, I took it to the lawyers for that group of men and women who were suing the United Church, and they used it in their court case, and as a result, after about 2 years, the court decision was that both the United Church and the federal government were equally liable. Now, that was for what had gone on in the O'Byrne School. That was a really important landmark decision, because after that opened the floodgate to all the lawsuits, and in the course of about 3 years, it went from a few hundred, I think it's over 10,000 now, the lawsuits against the churches. So one document like that is very important, and in fact, it's important in another way too, because we often use this in healing circles. One of the issues that Native people deal with all the time is, the sadness and even hatred they have towards their parents for not having gotten them out of these terrible places. I mean, you often find that working with people where they can't forgive their parents. They say, "Well, why didn't they help me? Why didn't they get me out of there?" And because within the family, they don't talk about these things that happened to them. Nobody ever knows what went on. So I remember in Nanaimo about 2 years ago, I was in the longhouse there, and there was a group of these folks. They were in their 60s and 70s. And I got up and I said, well, they couldn't, according to this document, they couldn't come for you because they weren't your legal guardian anymore. And they didn't even know that. And I remember passing this document around to them, and they were crying. And they were like letting go. I mean, it was almost like you could see this amazing weight going off their shoulders of forgiveness, realizing now that they were caught in a system. There was no point blaming each other anymore. They were caught in this system that they didn't even know about. And we then took this and burned it in the fire. And it was amazing healing that went on that day. And because I think that when it's a word that's thrown around easily, healing, and there's almost the assumption that if you give people a bit of money, that's somehow healing to them, or an apology, a verbal apology. In according to at least the Hausa people that I know, they have no word for I'm sorry in their language. That an apology is not an abstract idea, because you can only make restitution by doing something. You can't. The idea of an apology doesn't make any sense to them. And so it's really ironic that the churches would be making these verbal apologies without even asking them first whether that has meaning to them, right? But in terms of healing, when people can name their pain, they can name what happened to them, and they can see that it wasn't just them, it was a whole system done to them and many other people. Suddenly, and I experienced this in Toronto yesterday, suddenly people break out of their individual despair and they start connecting with all the other people who went through the same thing. And that is part of the empowerment that I think has the government and the churches worried. Because when that starts happening, then people feel healthy enough and strong and brave enough to be able to say, yeah, well, they not only molested me, but I saw kids being killed. I know about the sterilizations, et cetera. And it's that, you know, a lot of the work I do is that I'm helping the people regain their voices so that the whole story can come out. So that's, the importance of this, how this kind of research connects with, you know, the people's lives on the ground and how it's helpful that way. The other thing that, you know, just looking historically in terms of the residential schools, in 1929 when this happened, there was a period, and I don't think it was coincidental, between 1927 and 53 in Canada, no Indian person could hire a lawyer. And if you're a lawyer and you took on an Indian client, you were disbarred. And they never gave a reason for that. The law societies and the government never gave a reason for that. But when you look at what was going on, that was a period in which, and I think I made reference to this last time, areas like BC, the resources were being opened up in a big way. The multinationals were going into these territories in a big way, especially American multinationals after the war. The hydroelectricity, the mining, the trees, they were all fueling the American post-war industrial boom. And the land became very important politically, not just economically. And so there had to be a way to get these people off their land quick. And so you find in the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, the worst period of these atrocities going on. Most of the people that I talk to who have stories of the sterilizations, you know, these pedophile rings that were operating, the other things, invariably they're in the 1940s and 50s. Now, that could be because of the sample of people involved and the age they are, but when you keep hearing these stories over and over coming from the same period, you know there was something in particular going on then. Because of that legal climate whereby there was no defense, people couldn't go to court, it meant that the only way people had to fight back was either hiding their children or burning the school down. And in fact, in the records in UBC, you find that again and again, an amazing number of residential schools were burned down on the coast. And so there was resistance. I mean, in fact, when I was in Alberta on the Blue Quills Reserve north of Edmonton, they told me that in 1970 what they did, the parents, they were sick and tired of this this Catholic residential school and the abuse that had been going on. So one day they went in there, and when the Indian agent showed up, and I talked to one of the guys who did this, they got out a gun. He said it wasn't loaded. We just held up this empty gun to the head of the Indian agent, and they took this guy prisoner. And they said, you're not getting out of here until you call Ottawa and get these blankety-blank nuns and priests out of the school. And apparently, Chrétien was Aboriginal Affairs Minister then. He flew these parents out to Ottawa, and they negotiated the removal of the priests and nuns from that school. That had never happened anywhere else before. That was in 1970 in north of Edmonton. After that, you see in the next couple of years the same thing happening right across the country. Almost every residential school was either turned over to the bands or closed altogether. Now, sadly, a lot of the abuses continued even in the native-run schools, because when you do this to a generation or two of people, it's perpetuated. There's a group of people who went to the St. Mary's Catholic School in Mission. And one woman was describing how things got even worse after the band took it over, because the guys running the school were, each one of them was a pedophile. And it was like a reign of terror. So it's not as if this is kind of like natives are the good guys, whites are the bad guys issue. The thing to realize that this whole climate affected both cultures. And that's part of the tragedy, and that's why even today there are some native chiefs who are doing their utmost to block this stuff because of their own personal implication in some of these crimes. But the general pattern is that by the 60s and 70s, the residential schools were getting phased out, because they had done their job. I mean, the land was pretty much in the hands of white people. The reserves in Canada, on average, are tiny little parcels of land. And, you know, they achieved their aim, which was to deculturalize and make Native people pretty much landless, poor people in their own land. And, again, you just have to look at the death rate consistently. I mean, it wasn't as if half the kids died in 1920, and then by 1930 and 40 it had fallen off. That's not what happened. When you look at it, the death rate is staying constant right across the decades. So, you know, if you pretend this is not Canada for a minute and hear that that's going on in some country, the first conclusion you'd probably come to is that, well, there was the intent to continue to do that to keep the numbers down for some reason. And I do believe that there was a policy of culling down the numbers of Native people to probably 50% or less of what they were originally in order to manage them more effectively. The main way this happened was by a practice of exposing children to communicable diseases, as we described earlier, and then just not treating them. So if you can imagine whole dormitories of kids being deliberately exposed to tuberculosis and then just left to cough their life away, I mean, it's horrible to think of. And you have to ask yourself, who are the kinds of people who could do that? And one of the you know, one of the things that really became obvious to me after a while in this is that the only, like bionology, I actually knew when I was growing up in Winnipeg, I knew my next door neighbor, they were a German family. And my best friend, Chris Martin, his dad, believe it or not, was in the SS. And he used to come over, and my parents and him didn't really get along, but my dad's eldest brother was killed in the war, so, I mean, there was a lot of friction. But he was saying once, I remember my mom telling me this, that what they did as a conditioning process in the SS, they were each given a little puppy, and they raised this as their own, and they were told, this is going to be your dog, like guard dog. And so, you know, they formed a real bond between. And then one day they were ordered to bring their full-grown dog into this hall, and they were given piano wire, and they said, strangle it. And the ones who couldn't do it were thrown out of the SS. So that's, you know, any when you look at the special forces in any military, they go through a similar deconditioning, dehumanizing process.
Selection.
Yes.
Selection, selecting those
exactly.
who are fit to be there in SS and those who are not.
Right. And now the same process had to have occurred in the residential schools. Otherwise, how could the staff have done these things? They could only have been done by people who had lost any human connection with the Native kids. So the thing to look at, too, is what was that process? And that's all got to be documented, because that's really at the heart of how this could have happened. You know, I there was a forum we held in February of 98, downtown Vancouver at the SFU Harbor Center, and there was over 400 Native people there that night, and they were all survivors of these schools. And halfway through the evening, this white woman stood up at the mic. I don't like using that term anymore, white, but you know what I mean, non-Native, European. Marilyn Matthews, and she said that she had been a matron at the Alberni Residential School for 1 year, and she had found a child being beaten with a piano leg by another matron, and she said the blood was flying. This kid was being beaten to death. So she grabbed the woman doing it and piano leg, and she grabbed the woman doing it and just cold-cocked her and knocked her out, right, to save the child. Well, she got hauled before the principal, John Andrews, who I'm glad to say was finally put on trial a few years ago. And Andrews fired Marilyn, not the woman who was beating the child. And she said, you know, what about this child? I mean, you know, she was killing her. She said, Andrews said, and she quoted this guy, anything that happened to the little squaw would have been preferable to losing that woman who, because she plays the organ on Sunday morning in church. Now, that's the principal of a residential school speaking. It isn't just some thug they've hired to work in the furnace room. It's like the legal guardian of these kids is saying it's okay to kill children. Okay, now, in a way, what more evidence do you need than the regime of terror going on in those schools? When I shared that example, I once spoke at a, believe it or not, a United Church. They smuggled me in somehow. I told that to the people, and the church people, they were fairly sympathetic, but when I told them that one, they just couldn't believe it. They said, no, you've got to be making that up. No one would do that. And I said, well, this is an eyewitness who was there, and I've had Native people corroborate even worse things that the guy did, John Andrews. But they just couldn't believe it because there's this mental barricade to believing that our culture and our churches and that could have been part of it. My throat is getting sore, so I think I'm going to stop soon. But to show you, I think, where this is leading, the residential schools were closed, but the thing to understand is the climate and the damage continues. One of the way it continues is through the whole foster care system, not foster care, foster homes. In the area around Port Alberni now, about two-thirds of the children are still not living with their own parents. They're in white homes. So it's like the residential school has been privatized into white homes. And similar kinds of abuses and degradations go on in those situations. And there's a syndrome that was identified by court psychiatrists a few years ago, and that's the intergenerational residential school syndrome, whereby people are suffering now from the effects, even if they never went to the residential school, because their parents did. And what's really odd is that the people like my age or younger who never went to the res school but whose parents did exhibit exactly the same traits, suicidal tendencies, self-abuse, all the same traits as if they had gone. And, you know, so you don't have to have been physically present in these schools to continue to suffer the effects. Now, when you multiply that, I mean, these are literally every Native family is affected by this. I mean, it's the single worst cause of all of the problems in Native communities. And, again, I would make the argument that it's not accidental. When you have a system designed to eradicate a certain group of people, a system of genocide, you can't turn it off. The only way it got turned off in Europe was because Nazi Germany was militarily defeated. But that never happened in Canada. The system that did this has never been destroyed. So the institutions that did these things are still in power. So that's the main dilemma, and yet it's also something you have to recognize. Otherwise, none of this makes any sense. And neither does it make any sense why the perpetrators are continuing to be basically get off the hook. I think to the present time, they've only convicted two people. After 7 years of the official RCMP investigation into the residential school, two people have served time. So I think I'll leave it at that. Why don't we open it up for discussion and questions? I know I rambled a lot. I apologize, but okay. Thank you. Let's open it up for questions and comments.